I did have a computer question for you.
Write it down on an index card.
I had a problem with my notification D something. It was taking like 99%, and I Googled how to fix that. I had something, it'll occur to me, but I guess we should. So this isn't the show. Are we starting the show now?
This is so confusing. We're in it. We already started it. We're in it. The confusion is all, you have caused confusion and delay.
You did that. You're the
You're
the narrow gauge guy. I could be Sir Topham Hatt, who has a much less flattering name. That
they were like the steamies, and what were they, like the diesels? Well, what were the diesels called?
If memory serves, and this is from memory, Sir Topham Hatt, who has an unflattering name in England, as usual, I think they call him the Lounge. And then I think he has a brother who runs the narrow gauge railway, and he's a slender fella. So I don't know what they call him. Maybe a nonce. I don't know. Can't believe they took that word from us. It's such a good word.
Did they take it for?
If you say nonce in front of somebody who's from England, you know what that means there.
I do not.
Okay. It means you're as they would say, a pedo.
Oh, does it? Ew. No, that's not good. I only know it from the computer science thing.
Well, yeah, and poetry. I was explaining. I was carrying on about this to my lady friend and bemoaning the loss of the word nonce, because now I'm self-conscious about that, because like trousers and pants. Like I have to admit,
You're not in the UK though. You don't have to worry
about
it.
But it's ambiguous, John. It's ambiguous.
It's not ambiguous where you live.
You don't know that. You don't know me.
This is what happens when you try to make this sort of mixed use environment where you use some British.
I didn't do anything.
Place of residence, right? It's like, well, where are we? Are we using the UK words or are we using American words? Well, I want to use some of both, and now you can't say nonce.
Well, that's all drives me crazy. This ambiguation is important. I restarted Walking Dead, and there's a scene, you know, where there around episode 3. You know, they're up on the canyon by the rock quarry. And Dale's got his RV, and it's, you know, before Rick comes back, and they're talking on the radio, and they're not saying "say again," they're saying "repeat." So if you say "repeat" on a radio, don't be surprised if artillery fires, is what I'm saying. Words mean things, John. I just wanted to say I think I'm a hacker. I'll save it for later. But I want you to
in the golfing sense.
I don't know. A big hitter, big hitter, the llama. No, what's it called? A caddy, a looper. I don't know. I was thinking about the hacker ethos. I'm off my ADHD medicine for right now, so I don't have a stroke, and my brain's really smooth. So that's something to know in advance. But I was thinking about hacking.
Is that why you're doing a lot of stuff with TVs right now? Sounds like you're watching a lot of TV shows. You watched a bunch of Game of Thrones. You're restarting Walking Dead.
I do watch a lot of TV, and now with my new my Lys Simple system that I'm using. Did you see what I did there?
No, I didn't.
I said it's Lys Simple than it used to be.
You're trying to do like Lys, Casey.
Well,
Lys,
no,
Lys
he's always trying to make Singer Chang happen. You know, like Dean Pelton type things. That's his Lys is his version.
But it's always a Lys suffix, though. I don't think it's usually a prefix or a standalone word. Lyss. You can do that. Like careless.
Anyway, I think I'm a hacker. I'll save it for the show.
Okay.
Yeah. But I was thinking about, like, I realized the other day, I'm not a hacker in the sense. Okay, so here's the breakthrough for me. I think. I'm pretty positive we talked about this here. That idea of what is it that constitutes a hacker. And I don't know if it's the first definition, but one of the definitions of hacker, especially in, as you say, pen testing, is to determine how this system could be used not in the way that it was intended. Isn't that kind of fair? That's part of the hacker mentality, is like, let's do a thing with this that wasn't intended. It might be a fun thing. It might be a dangerous thing to prove a point. But really, it's about using the thing wrong. And we did talk about this, didn't we? The whole way of like, you know,
I think we talked about hacker versus cracker, because I think you're talking more about the idea of breaking into systems. But the larger hacker ethos is it's bigger than that.
Well, okay, maybe I'm not a hacker. But I'm just, you know what? Never mind. All I was going to say was I'm having a lot of fun right now with that app Descript, where you can make it say things. And I was playing a funny thing I did the other night last night. I played it for my wife, and she thought it was okay, funny. But I was just thinking about how my whole life, mainly out of, somewhat out of curiosity, partly out of scarcity, I would do stuff with stuff that you weren't supposed to do with that, with it. Like, I think it's a thing a kid does. They're unintentionally very curious about the world, and they'll just, can this flush down the toilet? What happens if I eat all these Flintstone vitamins, you know? And I'm just saying, like the idea, like, for example, I thought I basically invented the idea of using two tape recorders and what I came to call bouncing, not invented, but I was doing that with a boombox and an old cassette player, like when I was in high school. That's how my first version of multi-track recording. And I was just thinking about and it's not my idea. I'm probably more of a script kiddie in that sense, but I'm just interested in the idea, like, we take a thing and then use it for a different thing. I thought about it last night or 2 days ago when my lady was cleaning the bathtub because she wanted to control a small area. And I gave her the drill, and I gave her one of my drill brushes. Like, I think a drill brush is an example of that. A drill's supposed to be used for a drill, but, like, you snap a brush in there, and now you got a stew. You know what I'm saying? It's hacking in a way.
Well, you already have a drill brush, so wasn't the brush made with the knowledge that it was going to be attached to a drill?
It is, but when we made drills, that's not what we thought that would be for.
Ah, I see. So it's a disconnect between the drill manufacturer and the brush manufacturer.
Well, here's another one. Like, does your Honda Accord have what we used to call a cigarette lighter?
I'm not actually sure. I don't think so.
I think that's a pretty good example of something.
I know what you mean, though.
We know, I mean, very few people have used that for a lighter for a very long time, for a variety of reasons. Fewer people smoke, definitely fewer people smoke in their car. But owing to the fact that that was pretty standard on every American automobile, like, now the inflator that we have a really good inflator. You know what I mean? You set the PSI that you want for whatever the tire or whatever is, and it stops automatically. Like, the fact that runs off this 12-volt thing that used to be a cigarette lighter, I think that seems like a form of hacking.
Interestingly, my tire inflator runs off rechargeable batteries used for drills.
Mine does too. It has both.
Well, there you go.
Hakuna Matata. Mine's also got a little USB in case you need to, like, charge something. But I don't know. I didn't invent drill brushes. Anyway, that was Syracuse Talk. If you'd like Syracuse to talk about something, start a podcast. John, as is our custom here since 2011, I believe you have some follow-up.
Sure do. Let's start with last week when we were talking about things that were new to me on my first plane flight in 3 years. And one of them was a part of the sort of boilerplate announcements made by an automated voice at the beginning of the flight.
Oh, this is don't drop your kid. If you drop your Kindle, call the flight attendant.
Yeah, if you drop a cell phone or other device into your seat or crevices in your seat or whatever, do not adjust your seat. Call a flight attendant, and we will help you out. And I was wondering why that had made it to right in the front with all the other sort of things they have to say in every single flight. Was there an epidemic of people dropping their stuff? Is this just a really big problem? How did it graduate to that important position? And many people wrote in with what sounds like a very plausible explanation, which is the key part is the part where they say, don't adjust your seat.
But they weren't from Australia, just to be clear.
Yeah. I thought they were just saying, hey, don't try to get it yourself. But no, it's very specifically, do not adjust your seat, because according to these people's theory, what they're warning you about is if your phone or iPad or whatever slips down in the crevices of your seat, and then you adjust your seat, it could be that your thing slipped down between two parts of the seat, and then when you adjusted your seat, you crunched or pinched or bent your phone, and now you've got
especially with something like an AirPod, right?
Well, AirPods probably are smaller, but I think phones are probably the main one, because they're small enough to get into a seat thing, but long enough that they might sort of span two parts of a hinge or whatever. Anyway, if you crush or pinch or bend your phone in the crevices of the seat as you adjust it in an attempt to remove it, what you may end up doing is causing a fire in the plane, because our phones have lithium ion batteries in them. And if you puncture them or bend them, they could light on fire. And so that's why it gets elevated to the front of the, instructions for everyone on the plane. They just want everyone to know, hey, don't crush your phone in our seat and start a fire, because fire in a plane, bad news. So that makes sense to me, although I really do hope people are redesigning the seats to not have pinch points where phones can get stuck.
Can you just imagine how filthy it is down there?
Yeah.
Can you imagine?
Although I have to say, not that I fly a lot, but I do wonder if this is this a theoretical fear? Because I think even a single cell phone we got bent in half and caught fire in a plane, it would be the type of story that I would have heard. Because in general, fires on planes seem like the type of thing that would get a lot of coverage, if only because everyone posting about it on social media when they survived and got off the plane, but probably also in the sort of national news. Yeah. Because, hey, fire on a plane, that's a big deal. I've never seen one of those stories. Maybe yeah. They're just passing me by.
I haven't either. It's, I don't know, I'm trying to grow as a person. And one aspect of that is I'm trying to stop doing the, like, oh, here's a domain that I think I understand and I'm going to make a pronouncement about it, which is a thing that I do a lot. I'm trying to do that less. But I'm trying to take it on something like good faith that all the things that I regard as security theater, or better put in my wheelhouse, authority theater, like the constant demonstration of power, whether that's a physician or a flight attendant or whatever it is. There's all these things that, like, so I would like to try and understand that too. But then that leads you to, well, you know, there's the stuff like the shoe bomber thing, like you got to take your shoes off. But also, like, I don't know, it's just weird to me how they, I wonder how they decide when something, for example, reaches the level of this should be a recorded message. I guess one part of that is it's important. Another part of that is that people have to say it a lot. Another part might be that you have to say it like exactly, sort of like when you're on the phone with AT&T and they have to read you something, like if you're going to change your plan or something like that. I don't know. I wonder how that stuff, assuming good faith, I wonder how that rises to the point of, you know, a somewhat explanationless rule that probably does have a reason in practice. I bet what happens on a plane, obviously safety in the sense of you can't crash, don't do stuff that's going to crash the plane, and don't do stuff that's going to disrupt the flight in a way that makes the flight attendants or the pilot, and they're not there to serve you drinks. They are there primarily for safety. It's just that's a side thing they do. But it's just interesting to me, like what rises to that level and how they decide, you know, that becomes, you know, the kind of thing, the drone of announcements in an airport, for example. Like, it's hard to hear your flight being called. Like, if they're only, like, doing it over the speaker at this one gate, but over here, it's being, like, drowned out by, you know, don't leave your bag on its own and stuff like that. I don't know. I know systems are complex, and I just often wonder how something gets operationalized in a case like that.
Well, I mean, like I said, with the idea that I haven't heard any stories about things catching fire, I think it's probably at least a two-dimensional, matrix of things that go into it, which is how likely is this thing to happen? And if it does happen, how bad is it, right? And you have to combine those. And so I think, as far as I can tell, the phones catching fire is extremely unlikely, but very, 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 very bad if it happens. And so that's how it ends up. Sure. You know, those two items combined gets it into the announcements up front. And honestly, there's not a lot of announcements up front. Like, the sort of mandatory ones are, you know, how the seatbelts work, where the exits are, what to do if you're in an exit row. You know, like, it's not like they're droning on for, you know, 30 minutes or whatever. And this announcement was pretty succinct. You know, it's not song and dance. It's not the Virgin thing where it's a music video and all that other stuff, right? So I think there's plenty of room for it. And I totally agree that if they know that they have seats on this plane that have potential pinch points for your phone, yeah, leave that announcement in. Although then I worry, like, because they didn't say that, again, they did mention the infant life vest, but they didn't say, you know, if you lose your phone in your seat, do not adjust your seat, because if you do, you might start a fire. They don't say that, right? So I think a lot of people hear that and go, yeah, if I drop my phone, I'll just get it myself. I'm ignoring this part of the announcement.
Yeah, but, you know, it's part... I don't know. Maybe I'm just a cynic or something, but, like, I feel like part of the problem with what it feels like theater, either whether it's that security authority or whatever it is that if you've got a rule by fiat that doesn't seem attached to anything, or you're saying something that's obviously not true, I think it kind of hurts your credibility. I mean, I don't know.
But in some cases, explaining the truth behind the rule makes things worse, right? And so they don't say anything. And so, you know, so they could have a couple of choices. They could not say anything. They could make up a false reason that, you know, like the whole idea is, like, what is your goal? If your goal is compliance, the most straightforward path to getting people to comply may not be to tell them the truth. So perhaps You know, I don't know in this case whether telling them it's a fire hazard would help or hurt. But like, if that's your goal, you can, all sorts of avenues are open to you. How to get there, right? You can tell them to do something different than you actually want them to do. You can tell them to do the thing you want them to do, but then make up a false reason for it that is shown to have the highest chance of making them do the thing you want them to do. But the sort of the good faith thing is the assumption of this feedback is true, that look, what they're actually trying to do is prevent a fire in the cabin of the plane.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm going to add a link. I think the CMS is being weird, but I'm going to add a link for water landing Wikipedia entry, which includes times that planes have quote unquote landed on water. And I realize that I am at this point doing what sounds like a Jay Leno bit from, I want to say 1986, you know, we're not going to go careening into the water. We're going to land on the water. But like think about how much of that stuff, all that is about like the safety of what happens if something goes wrong mechanically with the plane. And the truth is, if your plane goes into the water, you're probably dead. If the plane does anything but land on wheels, you're probably going to be in a really bad way.
But then you got Sully messing this up for everybody.
He hates birds. But, you know, with that, I mean, I think part of that is maybe putting people at ease. If they, you know what I mean? Like, if you're a nervous flyer and you didn't get that talk, you know, maybe that makes people, you know, a little bit weird. I don't know. I think the flight attendant shouldn't have been so mean to me. That's what I think.
Mm-hmm.
This episode of Reconcilable Differences is brought to you in part by Sourcegraph. You can learn more about Sourcegraph right now by visiting about.sourcegraph.com. So you've hired a brilliant developer. Well, that's great, but now you have to get them onboarded. If your company is growing, onboarding new developers will be a common occurrence, but it's a big undertaking each time. One of the biggest challenges for new hires is to get up to speed with the project that their new team is working on. And that can be tricky if the code bases your developers are working in are already large. Well, thankfully, Sourcegraph makes it easy to move fast, even in those big code bases. Developers know that knowledge is most useful when it is findable. Centralization is helpful, but given the fact that most companies store knowledge in at least two different locations, how do you make knowledge accessible to those who need it? As a code intelligence platform, Sourcegraph gives developers what they need to drive their own learning over time and in different situations. Teams without Sourcegraph need to rely on asking colleagues or reviewing out-of-date documentation, which is cumbersome and time-consuming. But with Sourcegraph, every developer can search across millions of repositories to find specific code, saving time for themselves and everyone else. So when questions do come up, you know it's the big stuff that's worthy of the extra time. Sourcegraph was created to make developers' lives easier. Today, they work with leading companies across every industry, including 3 out of the 5 top tech companies, alongside companies like PayPal, Uber, Plaid, GE, Reddit, and Atlassian. Now it's time for you to check it out. You go to about.sourcegraph.com to learn more. That's about.sourcegraph.com to find out why some of the biggest tech companies in the world use Sourcegraph, and to see what they can do for your company. Or just click the link in the show notes to let them know you heard about it from us. Our thanks to Sourcegraph for supporting Reconcilable Differences and all of Relay FM.
We have some other stuff here, but I think we can go. Do you want to hop into our minis? Oh, hey, everybody. It's one of those weeks where you get some bonus content. If you choose to support our program by going to relay.fm/rd/join, you can tithe us a little bit of money, which helps us have this as a job. And it also gets you, once a month, you get some bonus stuff. And we got a pretty good bonus teed up for this week. What's our bonus this week, John?
This week we're going to have some updates on what you described as half-empty nest syndrome, based on the idea that my oldest child is off to college now. And when we last talked about it, he was soon to be leaving, and now he has left. So I'll talk a little bit more about that.
Sounds good to me. Which brings us to we're gonna do another parade of minis. I got a few mini ideas.
You really don't want to talk about the employee evaluation stuff that you put in here?
I want to talk about it super much. I thought that was something you maybe didn't want to talk about.
No, but you are wrong. I'm ready to talk about it.
This had a genesis and lots of things, but the clearest genesis here was, I'm going to say, on maybe the after show before last or so, I said something to you. Maybe that was where I said, this is what we should do, our 7th anniversary performance review.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not trying to be dramatic, but I think that triggered you a little bit. That's a phrase that has, like I said, that's like me telling General Heiser that there should be more accountability. Like, that's the wrong word to choose when you talk to a general. And when you talk to John Siracusa, you talk about employee reviews, performance reviews, you get a reaction. And we found a couple other things that have come over the transom since then. It was specifically with regard to the, what's called 360 reviews. Uh-huh. What's it called?
360s. 360 degrees, yeah, getting feedback from all around you. All right, so there was a Twitter thread. We'll start with that one. The Twitter thread by Liz Ryan, describing the downsides of 360s. Now, it's a humorous thread. I don't want to ruin the sort of climax, but it goes through saying, here's what's wrong with 360s, and it doesn't do the Godwin's law, right? But it does something pretty close to it. And so it
invokes authoritarianism.
right. And so here's the thing with this. Like, you read this thread about 360s and all their downsides and the sort of the way they manifest in real companies and how they're bad and not good. And because 360s have been around for so many years, and anyone who's been in a company that has had them, I don't know if they have, trauma from them, but they can relate to this thread, because it's like, oh, you've experienced this and you didn't like it, so let me just describe it, right? But I'm not entirely sure that, like I said when we talked about it, that 360s are actually worse than the thing that came before them. I do know that they're bad and they have things that are wrong with them, and those things have been allowed to sort of cement themselves into the culture, because once 360s get cemented, all their downsides get cemented as well, and people start to game them and so on and so forth. But the problem is, like, with this type of thing, like, here are all the things wrong with 360s, right? At the end of it, you're like, we should abolish 360s. But then you're kind of left with the problem that 360s is trying to solve. There are a lot of problems they were trying to solve. Like, in the absence of getting feedback on everybody from all sorts of people who they interact with during their job, you end up in a place where, one bad boss who doesn't like you can prevent you from ever getting promoted, and then you leave the company because you're annoyed by that, and then that's bad for the company because you were actually a good employee and he was just a bad manager who had a grudge against you or something, right? That's one of the things that the 360s are trying to get rid of, right? So every time there's something in the corporate world that is introduced, when it's first introduced, like, this is great because, for example, whatever comes after 360s, I'm sure there's like three or four things that have come after and say, 360s are bad because X, Y, and Z. We should do whatever this new thing is. And they describe the new thing. And in the year the new thing rolls out, everyone's like, oh, God, this is so much better than 360s. Remember 360s? They were so terrible. This new thing is great. And it's going to be, it's going to be better in these ways, right? But then just 10 years from now, someone does a funny Twitter thread about the new thing, about all the bad things about the new thing. So it's a difficult problem. And I can feel for that. But another thing with sort of corporate culture is that it's very difficult to dislodge. Like, very often you have to wait for like the CEO of the company to literally die or retire for stuff like this to change, because it can go all the way to the top and they've just decided 360s are the way to do it, because
it's part of the culture, and you're sort of by proxy like attacking leadership and leadership decisions if you try and disassemble any of the stuff that they think, was a really maverick move.
Yeah, or maybe they were around when they brought out 360s to replace the old thing, and it was such a relief to everybody, and they were so proud of that accomplishment, and they don't want to believe that the thing they introduced is actually bad. It's just, we just need to tweak it, so on and so forth. And, with decisions like this of like, how do we do performance evaluations in this company? That stuff tends to change slowly if the same people are in charge. If new people are in charge, things can change real fast. But if it's a company where the senior leadership hasn't changed in years and years, it's really difficult to dislodge 360s, right? To give an example, one of the companies I work for had a practice of making employees talk to customers. I think I talked to you privately about this, but anyway, now that
I remember Zappos did something like that, and when I did a talk at GoDaddy, specifically about GoDaddy, their customer service, they put a lot of resources into customer service. I think that was another place where, like, the classic sort of Mike Dukakis, George H.W. Bush, like, go out and like work as a hot, go out and do a job, a Richard Scarry job for the day. You know what I mean? So the idea is, are you doing customer service, or like, are you doing surveys when you talk to customers? What does that mean?
I mean, this company was calling customers to basically surveys to see how they're doing and what their issues are, whatever. But, the, you know, like you described, it was the idea at like the CEO camp and wherever they go to get their CEO ideas from each other, was that every employee would do it. I don't care what your actual job is for, you know, one day or 1 hour during one day a year, you're going to call a bunch of customers and you're going to talk to them and hear what they have to say. Either you're going to give them a survey, you're going to take their feedback or whatever.
Not a bad idea for somebody. What's the famous phrase? I think it's actually from 1800s in the theater of war. No plan
survives contact with the enemy.
No plan survives contact with the enemy. Yeah, yeah. And in that instance, whatever your big idea is about how the company works could be really undone by an afternoon of talking to people who are frustrated about the product that you make.
Yeah, I mean, so you can see the reasons why they would roll out a program like this. But, you know, and the CEO is super into it. It was like everyone should have contact with them. But the flaws with the system are obvious. It's like, okay, well, if it's not your actual job to talk to customers, maybe you're bad at it. Like, you know, you aren't hired to do this. It's not in your skill set. You don't know how to do it. And you're never going to get enough practice doing it if you only do it one day a year, right? And so you're basically subjecting your customers to contact with employees who don't know how to talk to customers. So that's bad, first of all. And the second thing that's bad, and the main thing that is relevant to my point,
and they don't do the corollary or the obverse. There's probably not a program where people from customer service come in
and check out a
repo and work.
Right. Yeah. And I just do it for one day, so you know what it's like.
Yeah.
What bad could happen from that? But the second thing is that
I don't like all these braces.
Yeah, let's just delete all those.
Why are all these tabs in here?
the reason that it kept coming up in this company is because the employees hated it, right? Like, if it's not your job to do
it,
this,
must even kill morale. Hey, can you forgive me? I need to be the dumb guy here, and perhaps there are listeners who were also the dumb person. And because we did talk about this in an after show, what I took away from you talking about performance reviews and 360 in particular, the one that really stuck with me. Well, in the same way the force ranking, you know, at Microsoft or whatever kind of sticks with you. So the part of 360 that stuck with me, what you said is you have to, you're talking to somebody who I guess is like your boss or whatever, and you're doing a review of a peer of yours usually, and you have to say X number of positive things and X number of things they could be better at. Is it correct that that's part of the 360 review?
Yeah, often it has much more structure than that, of like strengths and weaknesses with a certain granularity, but always a plus and a minus in every category or subcategory.
Okay, so there's more to it than the more to it is mostly in the implementation, but that if when you say 360 inside of an organization, most people mean that you're gonna have to do that process, however it's designed in the company and implemented. You're gonna have to do that process of giving strengths and weaknesses for people you work with, correct?
Yeah, and the reason it's 360 is it's people from all around doing the org chart. People above you, people below you, people, you know, at the same level as you. That's why it's
a 360. Terrible idea.
Right. Well, you know, it's better than just having the feedback go in one direction.
I don't know, man. My
point with the CEO who loved the, you know, making everybody call the customers and everything, was that when the employees complained, they complained for years. But because it was this one guy, this one CEO who really loved the idea of the system, no matter how many times the employees said, yeah, but here are the downsides and we don't like it and we're demotivated and we're demoralized. And do you want your employees to be demoralized? And then they would argue, said, but you shouldn't be demoralized. It's just one day a year. Why are you a big baby? And then people would quit. And it's like, well, what's your goal here? Do you want to keep your good employees? Well, that wasn't a good employee. And it's like, is this the hill you want to die on? And the answer was, yes, this is the hill I want to die on. And so that's why often things like 360s can take a long time to get phased out, because sometimes they are tied to a person.
Yeah, well, to a certain kind of person, that just sounds like belly aching, probably. Like, oh, you complain about the donuts, you know, you didn't like the color of your mini golf ball, the roller coasters were too scary. Like, you know, we put out all this wicker just for you. Like, it probably just sounds like another bit of belly aching. But like, I remember when I probably mentioned this in that after show, but I did a junket one time to Microsoft with a bunch of other bloggers. Like Michael Arrington and Gina Trapani and whatnot. And that's when I first learned about force ranking, I feel like. And when it was described to me, it sounded so harrowing. And like, and very, to reference two shows that I'm watching right now, Game of Thrones, very like Walking Dead. Like there's something about it that is so, it's so dark. Like what if out of those, say, five people, like three of them actually are like some of the best developers you've ever had? And Force Ranking, you know, does this shape sort of thing where you're expected to act like there's a bell curve, whether it exists or not. Or I guess, again, the corollary is, well, what if all five of them suck? You know, I don't know. It's just, I can't imagine having to do that with people that I work with. I can't imagine doing that. And like, I guess the other side of that, and maybe I said this before, but like, if somebody in there is doing something that's really bad and really damaging, should you wait for the 360 to bring it up? Like, what is it okay to say? I'm carrying on, but I just feel like that's just one of those things in corporate culture that feels so unnecessarily tense and caustic and unkind in some ways to both the person doing the reviewing and being reviewed. But I understand why you don't like them.
Yeah, I mean, these are all just tools to try to make quantifiable a thing that is inherently harder to nail down, because you like it's at scale. You can't just rely on people having good judgment. That's not a plan. Everyone should just have good judgment and be kind. You know, well, you have to sort of, you know, what's the system? I need a system to work. I need numbers I can look at. I need something that can be uniform across a large organization so I
manage,
can tell if we're
manage,
doing a
manage.
Good job. Right, right. You know, you can't, the old way of just like, well, we'll just hire a bunch of old white guys and they'll just do everything the way old white guys do them and it'll work out fine, was not a good system. But, you know, the systems they've made to replace it with sets of rules and guidelines and thing that anybody can implement and that anybody can look at and say, have you implemented it correctly? And what are the results of your implementation? And what actions do we take based on the results, based on those rules, right? That's what we're trying to come up with. In the end, everything would obviously be better if we just had a bunch of people who are, you know, empathetic, kind, and really good at reading other people to just have good judgment all the time. But that's not a scalable system. And so they're always trying to come up with a scalable system that takes out the human element and replaces it with a rule book. And it's really hard to make one of those that doesn't degenerate into...
Well, it didn't work in the Catholic Church. The thing that made me want to especially talk about this is something that I saw today that just, I think, came out today. This is from the News Guild of New York, which I think is a union of people who work in journalism. I have not vetted this, but I thought it was interesting. News Guild, headline, Racial Disparities in Performance Evaluations at the New York Times. I just thought this was kind of an interesting piece. I have no way of, you know, saying how accurate it is, but the lead, the New York Times performance review system has for years given significantly lower ratings to employees of color. An analysis by Times journalists in the News Guild shows. The analysis was relied on data provided by the company D2LED. Being Hispanic reduced the odds of receiving. It's an interesting way to phrase that. Being Hispanic reduced the odds of receiving a high score by about 60%, and being Black cut the chances of high scores by nearly 50%. Asians were also less likely than white employees to get high scores. And you know, as anything, again, we got to bring in Kieran Healy. Maybe we can make him, you know, our statistics czar. But I just thought that was interesting, and I think related, but maybe not related to 360 in the obvious way. I mean, it's related to 360 because it's about reviews and whether we're getting at it. But I think like that, like all of these au courant ideas or even old ideas for how to quantify things that are difficult to quantify, it's, I don't know, it feels like it's so limiting the sort of the frame that you put on it. And I think it's entirely natural that the results you get out of that are gonna be so... Is there anything like that that is like a big corporate thing? This is a dumb question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. So it sounds to me like 360 would be like in the top 10 for you of things that are not a thing that you look forward to doing and maybe a thing you don't think works so great. Is that fair to say?
Top 10, sure.
What's an example? Is there an example of... Can you flip that around? And is there anything that is a corporate culture thing along the lines of 360 that you think is a good idea? Or even if you have a thought on this, are there ways that, you know, managers love to manage? That's why they call them managers. Somehow I manage. Is there anything that quantifies the difficult to quantify that you think is a good idea? Is there, well, for example, another way to take it and turn it is to say, well, you know, the if the biz dev guys have to evaluate the developer guys, like there's all kinds of reasons that might be a little bit cockamamie. But on the other hand, are there ways to tease out things that are great about that person that we may not have caught because you're an introverted coder or whatever? Are there any things like that that you think are successful generally?
Well, like I said earlier, almost all of the systems we have are better than the ones that predate them. It doesn't mean they're good, but they're most of the time, the sort of large national scale trends, whether it be agile software development or decentralized version control or 360s, are replacing something that was worse, that everyone pretty much agrees was worse. It doesn't mean the new thing is good, and it doesn't mean the new thing's not going to degenerate and devolve and be gamed and be terrible and become the thing that everybody hates, but still they are better than what they replaced. And related to this racial disparity story, any system like 360s or something like that that was made in an age before corporate, you know, systems had as much acknowledgement as they do today of the problems of systemic racial injustice, right? If they come before that, there's nothing in 360s that addresses any of these needs. So it's not a surprise that 360s simply pass through without modification all of the inherent prejudices and legacy of, you know, discrimination and the fact that all the bosses are old white men. Like, it just passes straight through 360. So it's not 360s causing this. It's 360s not doing a single thing to address it because it wasn't on their radar as a thing to be addressed. And examples of things that I think have been good or better are things that are newer than 360s. Things that came out later in my career at these big companies that did, for example, actually codify in ways that it had never done before rules about inclusion and discrimination and bias, you know, new systems that actually had part that built into them in some way. And do they do a good job of it? Almost certainly not. And some of them is humorously
but they're trying, but at least it is a factor
at least it is in the stew. The stew is still terrible, and you know, like, there's going to be all sorts of things you can make fun of about their sort of embarrassing, ham-fisted attempts to try to do the right thing, right? But at least it's part of the conversation now, whereas there's nothing in 360s that includes anything about that. Because again, if you're in an organization that's 100% lopsided and all your bosses are old white men, right? And you're getting, you know, and you end up getting bad reviews or whatever, it's like, there's nothing in 360s that says, okay, get opinions of everyone around you. But hey, if everyone around you is nothing like you and has no idea where you're coming from and is constantly doing things that are, you know, terrible and prejudiced that they don't realize against you and it makes you annoyed, and that, you know, like, that's not anywhere in 360s, right? It doesn't account for that at all. Right. So I do think that almost all of the newer systems have tried to incorporate stuff like that, and you know, even if they're not successful, at the very least there are conversations happening about that, often bad conversations that cause people to leave the company, but still it's an improvement over never saying anything about it at all and not having it incorporated. Because imagine when 360s came out, we said, yeah, but what about that? They'd be like, that's, what are you talking about? That's not, like, they weren't ready to build corporate systems with that in mind, and now they are ready to at least pretend they're trying to.
Right. Yeah, one of my favorite phrases I've learned in the last year that's really become an important thought technology is G.K. Chesterton had this notion that became known as Chesterton's fence. You've heard of this, right?
I don't think, tell me what it is. Maybe I'll
adjust on the basic idea is, and I'm trying to, I'm going to mangle this a little bit, but Chesterton, so the idea behind Chesterton's fence is, you're like, okay, I've got this new piece of property and it's got this weird fence and it's really ugly and it's rusty. And like, I'd really like to have something nicer and newer. And you tear the fence out. But what you skipped was understanding why the fence, obviously importantly, why the fence is there, but arguably more importantly, why the fence is still there, which gets very nuanced, right? This is something that's become very, very important to me, is this idea of like, and this is a thing I'm working on in the document, is trying to avoid when you talk to people, like somebody goes, you know, we all do this, but somebody goes, okay, for example, I'm not saying that Casey said this, but for example, you're like, oh, I wish TiVo would put out a new TiVo. And somebody says to you a sentence that begins with, you know, the phrase, why don't you just? Like, why don't you just use this service? Or why don't you just use that service? And like, I feel like that, it may not be a bozo bit, but it's a little bit of a flag, because that person is incurious about what made this problem difficult. to solve, right? Like, it's been said that all the easy problems are solved. Any problem that exists because it's difficult to solve. Well, why can't you just go do this? Why don't you just X? Well, you know, we can't just X. And if you're curious, I could give you lots of reasons, you know, but if you tear out that fence, well, first of all, maybe that fence, tearing out that fence represents construction and you didn't get a permit for that. Maybe it's because there's cows that migrate through here once a year and they'll wander in. You know what I'm saying? But I love that concept of, like, before you change something, it's valuable to understand why it's there and why it's still there. And I bet there's elements of that with 360. And I think you're implying that with what you're saying, which is what we used to have was pretty bad. What we've got now is not great, but if we just tear that out and default to whatever, we're breaking the rule of Chesterton's fence.
Yeah, so I'm looking at this definition of Chesterton's fence on this Wiktionary site. And because there's no year attached to it, like Chesterton's fence, 1867 or 2005, right? It's hard for me to know whether, I guess I can surmise it based on your description and your use of it, but it's hard for me to know in isolation whether it's put forward as a good or a bad thing. So the one sentence description here is the principle that reform should not be made until the reasoning behind.
Yeah. Yes. Is understood. Yeah. Well, I mean, for example, like if you live in a house like I live in, my house has a lot of, forgive my saying, hacks. There's a lot of stuff you need to know. For example, when we had a TiVo, we had a direct TiVo, we called it, starting in, I want to say 2001, I just loved it. But, and like you, we had a receiver. We had a big old CRT like TV, and I eventually, because it's something I also did for a job, I wrote up 3 pages of documentation about how to watch TV, because it required you got to turn on the TV. You know how this works. I mean, I went through this with my goddamn stepfather, who just never got the idea of how the cable box works. He would change the channel manually to what he wanted and be frustrated that when he went to arbitrarily say, you know, channel 44 on UHF, it wasn't WTOG. And I'd be like, no, you have to leave that on 3, and then you change it up here. Okay, do I go to 44? No, you don't go to 44. 44 now has a different number on the cable box from that. And our house is like that in a lot of ways. Somebody might walk in and go like in December and go like, well, if their house sitting, they might say, well, why is that bucket there? There's nothing in it. And you're like, well, there's not anything in it, but leave it there because that's where the roof leaks. If the roof leaks, when the roof leaks, that's where it leaks. And I think that's an example of what we're talking about here, I think. I don't know. I just think that's an interesting idea. Mainly it's the thought experiment that I try to pursue now of rather than saying, why don't you just, or why don't you, you know, just do this thing that just occurred to me, a very Twitter thing to say. Rather than that, express curiosity about what's made it difficult. And really, if you wouldn't bring me in for this, there's a reason I'm not in the corner office. I'm in a very slender office. But if you called me in to visit with somebody about this, I would want to pursue not so much what this was designed to fix at the time, but what you hope that this will do in the future. Like, look at the outcomes you want rather than this relatively blunt tool. You know, I don't know the answer to that. I don't get the big bucks, but that's, I don't know. I think that stuff is interesting.
So it sounds like you're kind of firmly in the camp that Chesterton's fence is telling people you shouldn't change it unless you understand the existing state of affairs.
Well, I think the idea, yeah, it's not a question of whether in this instance, the fence is a good fence or a bad fence, whether you like the fence or don't like the fence. It's way deeper than that. And we're giving fairly trivial examples at this point, but I'm thinking of, for example, I'm going to mangle this too, but in my environmental studies class in college, I was the first time that I learned about, oh, what is that game? Not Game of Life, but what's the similar game? Isn't there a game with like rabbits and wolves? Is that Game of Life or, you know, one
That's
of those?
Not Game
like,
of Life, but I know what you're talking about.
You know what I'm talking about?
I do.
Well, the idea was that, if memory serves, it was that wolves or coyotes were like wolves and coyotes are dying out. How do we keep these from becoming endangered or extinct? And so they introduced, I want to say, you can see where this is going to go. Like, they're like, okay, well, we'll fix the wolf problem by introducing more bunnies. And then, you know, the bunnies are overrunning everything. It throws off the ecosystem and it actually is bad for everybody. But it's one of those, it's a classic Merlin Mann thing. Like, of like, how do I fix it? I've done the XY problem. Like, once again, I've screwed this thing up. I'm way obsessed with the way that I'd like to implement this rather than what my goal is. And that's when you really screw yourself up. That's another example to me of Chesterton's fence, which is like the unintended consequences of just removing this. But I don't know. I don't know if I've ever read anything by him. A Lesson in Second Order Thinking. I want to put this in notes. This is where I first learned about it, I think. It's a pretty good blog. Called,
is this Mr. Chesterton?
No, Mr. Chesterton's my father. Call me GK.
Are you reading about the coyotes and wolves thing?
Oh, that was, I believe, I want to say it was a paper or a book, and I believe it was called Google Playing God in Yellowstone. See if that turns.
Yeah,
out.
No, that rings a bell. Now, but so the Chesterton's fence is from 1929. Right? So this that fits with what I was thinking, because when I read this Chesterton's fence thing, what I'm thinking is from a modern perspective, the context that this is most likely to come up in is the idea that there are people who want a change and that they're being resisted by people saying, oh, you shouldn't make this change because you don't understand why things are the way they are. And if you understood why things are the way they are, that
you don't understand you don't understand why we haven't removed it. You're pretending like we love the fence, but that's not the case. There's a lot of things we'd rather have than that fence, including either no fence or something different. But like, as I say, I keep using that word because it's critical. You're incurious about why it's still there.
Right. But the modern thing would be, okay, but what you're doing is this is a resistance to change by people who themselves don't actually understand why it's really there. Because like in public policy, for example, the simplified thing is like, oh, you just don't understand why we put the fence there. But really, it's like, okay, but if you five whys, to use another thing where you ask why five times to get down to the root cause.
I love five whys.
Really, to really understand the existing state of affairs, like you get down to white supremacy in like three whys on almost every policy in the entire United States, right?
What was the joke on Mythic Quest? Was it time to penis? Like how long it takes in a video game for somebody to make a penis? It's like all the stuff you hadn't accounted for.
And nobody wants that. Nobody who's saying like, well, don't be hasty with these reforms. You don't understand why we did this. It's like, no, you don't understand why you did this. You think you put the fence there for the cows. Really, it's like three whys later, you're at white supremacy. And you're like, wait a second, what? And, you know, and that is a lot of the resistance to change is from people who insist that, you know, the reason why these foolish people want to change this longstanding system is they don't truly understand this, what's good about this existing system. And the people who want change said, no, we do understand
it. Yeah.
We do understand it. It's you who doesn't understand what the system is really about because you can only focus on this one thing. I mean, it gets much more nuanced and complex after this, but that's when I look at Chesterton's fence from a modern perspective, I see it as someone defending the status quo. You don't understand why you can't have low income housing.
I totally get what you're saying. And yeah, so this is, I believe, where I first learned about this. Is it Furnham Street? What is the name of this blog? It's a blog I really like. What is the name? It's fs.blog, I think. But this, I believe, which I subscribe to, and this is where I first learned about it. I like the second paragraph. I'll put this in notes. Second-order thinking is the practice of not just considering the consequences of our decisions, but also the consequences of those consequences. Everyone can manage first-order thinking, which is just considering the immediate anticipated result of an action. It's simple and quick, a little bit Daniel Kahneman. It's simple, that was my note, usually requiring little effort. By comparison, second-order thinking is more complex and time-consuming. The fact that it's difficult and unusual is what makes the ability to do it such a powerful advantage. I think that's smart.
Yeah, I like Twitter is pretty good at that because Twitter threads are always like, once someone comes out with a thing and then someone comes out with the consequence of the consequence and someone comes out with the consequence of the consequence of the consequence. And they chase each other's tails in circle in these little simple circles around the, you know, the causality of like, well, if you did X, then Y. But if you did Y, then Z. And if you did Z, then Q. And they go around and around and around.
Which I know you love, people getting into a speculation war.
Yeah, I mean, every public policy thing is like this. Just Twitter is so interesting because you're not allowed to say too much. So someone can only go one step in a tweet. Like I saw someone arguing about like how to fix higher education. It's like we should do X, and then someone says, but if you do X, then Y will happen. And then people say, well, if Y happens, then Z will happen. And then if Z happens, then Q will happen. And then it's just like it's a Twitter thread. Just every person can only make one point. And by like tweet seven,
pretty soon a white supremacist is the chancellor.
Yeah, by tweet seven, no one remembers what they're even talking about. And just like boy, by the end, you feel like the final tweet in this thread should be, boy, this problem is more complicated than we thought, huh? Like, yeah. That's the conclusion of all these things. Like, no wonder this hasn't been solved. It's actually kind of a hard problem. So that simple solution in tweet number 2 and 3, I guess that's not the solution, because if it was, it would already be fixed.
This episode of Reconcilable Differences is brought to you in part by Doppler. You can learn more about Doppler right now by visiting doppler.com/L/diffs. In software development, secrets are private pieces of information that act as keys, and those keys unlock protected resources or sensitive data. Now, this can be stressful to configure and manage, especially when sharing secrets across different teams and clouds. Well, thankfully, those days are over. Introducing Doppler, the first universal secrets platform. It enables developers to automate the pain away of managing secrets, along with the hidden files used to manage them, also known as ENV files. Doppler is your team's central source of truth for secrets and app configuration across all environments and clouds. Whether they are in Docker, AWS, Vercel, or anywhere else, Doppler works where you work. As your stack evolves, Doppler remains simple. From startups to enterprises, more than 11,000 customers, big and small, are using Doppler so they can keep their secrets and app configuration in sync across devices, environments, and team members. So say goodbye to ENV files. Set up Doppler for your team in less than 4 minutes. You go and sign up right now. You go to Doppler, that's doppler.com/L/diffs, and that's all lowercase. Doppler.com/L/diffs. Go there now. Our thanks to Doppler for supporting Reconcilable Differences and all of Relay FM.
Moving on to some mini topics. You know, a funny thing happened. I'm given to believe that you're a listener of Due by Friday, and I made a reference when we were on a break from the show a bit ago. And let me just say, I'm not that particular guy. I do not assume, unless I know the people listen to the show. And you said to me the thing that you say about lots of things, which is a phrase you use a lot, which is that I'm really behind on podcasts. So one of the many questions that's been floating around with me, at least for a while, is, this is really obscure, probably. If this weren't a podcast, I wouldn't ask it. How has not having a, how has working on your own change the way, for example, that you consume media, and in particular, listen to podcasts? You haven't had a real commute in a while, but I've never heard you say, I'm really behind. Like, I'll mention the Flophouse, or I'll mention, you know, one or another thing. And you say in this way, it sounds like it's a weight on you. You're like, oh, I'm really behind right now. How has that changed?
I've been listening to podcasts for a long time, and every once in a while I'll get behind on something. And often when I'm really behind on a podcast, it's a sign that I just don't want to listen to it anymore. I should unsubscribe, right?
Totally.
But that's, you know, that's been going on for many, many years. But COVID really is the first time that I can recall getting massively behind. And it was on the Flophouse, right? Because when COVID started, for whatever reason, I mean, you know me in comedy, I just wasn't in the mood for a comedy podcast. I wasn't in the mood to laugh. It was because I was down. I mean, a lot of people, like, oh, when they're down,
it's something almost everybody was talking about COVID also. It was like, it felt like inescapable.
I mean, it depends on what kind of person you are. Because sometimes when people, I mean, the Flophouse themselves talks about this. Sometimes when people are, you know, feeling down either in their life or because bad things are happening in the world or whatever, they turn to a light, fluffy podcast to cheer them up. And I guess I'm not that kind of person, because when things were going bad with COVID, my reaction was, in this state, I can't imagine listening to a comedy podcast. So I fell way, 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 way behind on the Flophouse. Not because I don't like the show, but just because I wasn't ready. I wasn't in a place where I could hear a light, fluffy, humorous podcast. And not because they talked about COVID, but just like I wasn't up for that, right?
I totally agree with you. Again, friend of the show, Casey Liss, we share a love for the TV show Letterkenny. But Letterkenny is a perfect example of a show where I was trying to make this case to Allison on the internet not too long ago, of like, if I'm in the mood for Letterkenny, there's nothing else in the world that I want to watch. But if I'm not in the mood for Letterkenny, it's a tough fit. You know what I mean? There's certain kinds of wackadoo things. And so that's nothing against the Flophouse, but I know what you mean. Like, it felt pretty dire. And I don't know, it would be like, you know, jerking off on 9/11. It doesn't seem patriotic.
Yeah. And so that was my first real, and I had been behind on the Hop Flops before, but never to that degree, right? And so then I go, eventually I kind of came out of that, not because the pandemic's over, but just because I personally was in a place where I'm like, I'm ready to hear a funny, stupid podcast about movies again. And I looked down at my podcast player and it's like, wow, you are really far behind, like multiple years behind. But then I endeavored to start catching up. I'm still not entirely caught up, but I'm almost all the way caught up.
As a note in passing, I always use the wrong word. Completionist? Is that what you are? Like, you read your whole timeline. Mm-hmm. And I'm guessing, like with a Flophouse or similar, like even though that each show stands on its own, you don't skip episodes. Like, if, like, for example, right now Blank Check is doing Stanley Kubrick and recently did Bob Fosse. And like, I listen to some, but not all. Some I listen to more than once. Like, I'm fine with jumping, as you can imagine. But you're somebody, like, you're going to listen to all of them in order, or you're not going to listen, right?
Yeah, and the Flophouse has continuity. You have to listen to them in order. How are you going to get the running gags that expand over, you know, 15 years if you don't listen to them in order? But yeah, no, I'm doing them in order.
I missed the porthole of time.
Yeah, no, it's all connected. You have to do it that way, right? So that was the first big one. But that didn't have anything to do with self-employment. Like, I was still, you know, employed for most of COVID. The self-employment, what that has done to podcasting and all of my hobbies, at least in the short term, considering it's been like less than a year, is it is just everything that I used to do as like a leisure activity, whether it's watching television, watching movies, playing Destiny, listening to podcasts, all that has just been slashed to a fraction of what it was before. Hmm. I'm way behind on Destiny. I'm way behind on my TV shows. I haven't watched a movie in ages. If you look at how many movies I've watched this year versus last year.
On that fancy TV.
Yeah, I mean, you know, so it's everything is reduced to a fraction of what it used to be. And there are a lot of reasons for that I think we've discussed on the show. A lot of it is just sort of the panic of running around and doing all these things that you had that had built up while you were doing other things. And there's just many, you know, spinning plates and lots of other stuff going on, some of which we'll talk about in the after show. Lots of changes going on. I just haven't found myself doing a lot of those things. Podcasting in particular, yes, the lack of a commute really cuts it out, but also the lack of ever going anywhere, but also just like the amount of time when, you know, other people being in the house, for example, right? Well, you get a lot of podcasts listening done when you're like, okay, I'm going to be folding laundry for a while. I'm emptying the dishwasher. I'm washing dishes. I'm preparing dinner, right? I'm preparing lunch. I'm preparing breakfast. Basically, anytime I'm in the kitchen preparing food or cleaning up after preparing food, that's when AirPods can be in and I can be listening to podcasts, right? But what if your whole family is home because of the pandemic, because it's summertime, because whatever it is, then you can't constantly be listening to things in your headphones as other human beings that you have to interact with. And I'm not blaming them for this or anything. I'm just saying, like, the environment, the times when I used to listen to podcasts have disappeared or lessened drastically. So there's just less time to listen to podcasts. And I prioritize what I listen to. I prioritize listening to my own shows for whatever stupid reason I do. I do listen to my own shows to see, to remind myself what I said. We talked about this in past shows, to remind myself what I said and to hear, you know, how it went and everything. So I do have to listen to them before I record the next episode. And I do a lot of podcasts and they're really long. So that alone takes up a lot of time.
Yeah.
And so that's how you end up falling behind on things. Do by Friday, I've been caught up on Do by Friday since the dawn of the show. But due to a confluence of other events, my podcasting time has been, you know, cut down even farther and farther. And then all of a sudden I didn't have time to stay caught up on Do by Friday. And then it started to build up. And part of that was because I was trying to catch up on the Flophouse. And while I was catching up on the Flophouse, Do by Friday was building up. And it's like,
stress. You know, it's very stressful. It's like, you know, Marco has that great blah, blah text in Overcast where you could turn on the notifications badge. And the blah, blah text is something like, you know, if you need more stress in your life, like you're uncounted, you know, podcasts you haven't listened to can accumulate and yell at you the same way as your mailbox. Yeah, I get it.
I don't experience it as stress, but I do experience it as like regret. Like, boy, I wish I had more time to listen to those things. I wish I was caught up. I wish I could participate in the discussion my friends are having about the most recent episode that I haven't heard yet, right? I do have a little bit of regret. So it's not stress and it's not anxiety and it's not even really guilt. It's just like, oh man, that kind of feeling.
Yeah, yeah. It's interesting because, like, this is a little bit different, but I do feel like the whole pandemic. I'm just going to say this. I'm not going to blame anything else. I'm going to be a real sourpuss, and I'm going to say that maybe pandemic, maybe, you know. And when we say pandemic, we're not talking just about like COVID and masks and hand sanitizer. As you said, we're also talking about the people at the house and what you're doing, your state of mind, all that kind of stuff. But it also coincides with my sourpuss comment is that the professionalization of podcasts has led a lot of shows that I've liked for years to move in a direction that I'm not into. And I wouldn't mention that, except I guess I am quote unquote behind on a lot of shows, because the way a lot of these programs have professionalized makes it less appealing to me. So, you know, obviously there's a, what's that term I learned from Alex, a pod drop or whatever, that stupid practice of like putting another show in the feed. And on top of it all, of course, it's August. So theoretically, a lot of people are away, vacation, whatnot. But like, I'm a little bit sour about podcasts as a professional endeavor right now. And that feeds, and I understand I can listen to whatever I want, but like, it's just a little bit sour about a lot of few things, not a lot, but a few things in podcasts. And that contributes where I'm like, gah, this again. Like WNYC is just relentless about like, there's several shows I really like from that are WNYC shows. I like the New Yorker Radio Hour. I like On the Media. I like a lot of those shows, but like they're just relentless about promoting other things and like, you know, the weird the dynamic ad insertion stuff. Like I think those things contribute as well, at least for me.
Yeah, I tend not to listen to those types of shows, but I think it's like any show that gains enough popularity that people come in and say, you know, now that you've got X amount of popularity, you really need to be doing these three things to boost your profits. And then you go like, yeah. Oh, that makes sense to me, I guess. And then
well, I don't really like or listen to podcasts, so I'm fine doing whatever people tell me to do.
Yeah, well, if you tell me that's what happens when you get big listenership and we have big listenership, I guess this is just how it's done in the biz. And so a podcast that was once just very kind of informal and casual starts having all sorts of, you know, they start dropping other things in the feed.
The podcast that used to feel like a project of mine, like that dumb thing I made in Descript and posted last night. I was thinking about this. You know, I'm a hacker. But when I posted that, I was thinking like, this is what I, when I talk to Alex about stuff like the golden days of blogging or like that web, the sort of the Ajax web 2.0 era where people just making good stuff. Like, here's a present for you. We talked about this on Due by Friday. You'll hear it in a few months. But you know, that whole idea of like, I just made this thing, like it's okay to make money. This is like what you do. But like, I am a little bit sour about how much so many shows have kind of lost the thread on what, I don't know. I feel like, and that gets a little bit, that contributes to my frustration about opening Overcast and seeing this stuff. And like you sort of implied, like when you see a show that keeps coming up and you're not excited about it, or you're like, in fact, like, ugh, like this again, you know, oh, please check out this other series on like the history of the Gulf War or whatever. And it's, yeah, I don't know. It was not a perfect storm, but like at least an imperfect drizzle that has like kind of guided me in like pursuing my love of music more. Sometimes I just like need a little break. But what was I going to ask you? Oh yeah, so with regard to podcasts and things, let me ask you a question. The question I was going to ask you, this is really inside baseball. I was going to ask you a very loaded question, which is, like me, do you dislike when shows that you listen to for the chemistry of the two or three people has a guest on? I want to rephrase that, though, in a more sensible way. Well, does the appearance of a guest in general change how you feel when you see it pop up? And second to that, what are the shows where you tend to get excited about a guest versus like a guest?
Well, you mentioned, you know, being a completionist, but that's just one way I listen to shows. There are podcasts that I subscribe to that I just, you know, I pick and choose, right? So, for example, Song Exploder. I listen to very few episodes of Song Exploder, but I subscribe to it, and I see them go by, and I go, nope, delete, 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 delete. Ooh, I'm going to listen to that one. Delete, 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 delete. I listen to maybe like 1 in 15 because I know so few songs or have enough interest in them to do.
But it doesn't cost you anything to have that all coming in and to evaluate it. And I'm kind of like that with Kirk Hamilton's show. I love Kirk Hamilton's show. I love
Strong Songs. Same thing. Yeah.
Yeah. Strong Songs. But like sometimes I'm you know, knowing what that show is going to be, you know, there's some episodes like the one about the Hamilton song. That's like one of my favorite podcasts ever. But other times I'm like, I don't know if I'm really in the mood for like a complete breakdown of this whole thing.
So the guest question. some shows are interview shows where they have guests, and most of the guest shows I treat like that, where I'm expecting there to be guests, but I will just not listen to ones if I don't care who the guest is. Right.
Ezra Klein is a great example. Ezra Klein annoys the hell out of me as a host, but he has fantastic people on his show. So like I listen to the Ezra Klein show. I don't dislike him personally. He has a lot of the sort of tics that I don't love in a podcast, this is such a professionalization thing, the very long intro where you talk about the person and you establish all their bona fides, which I guess is important. Everybody does that to some extent. But like for example, that episode, I mentioned Son Roderick, but that episode with the guy who wrote the trauma book, that's how I learned about the trauma book, was that show. So if it's a show that's meant to have guests, I feel like that's a pretty different thing. I'm going to say something controversial. Okay. Flophouse is one of my favorite shows. Hi, Dan. I absolutely love, but, you know, like most pointedly, I guess, Blank Check, I'm there for the chemistry. Now, David and Griffin Newman's chemistry does not get overly disrupted by guests. And if it's somebody like Patton Oswalt recently in the last episode, or Lin-Manuel Miranda to talk about All That Jazz, I'm pretty into it. So like if Hallie is on, or, you know, one of the, that's her name, right?
The star of the show, yes.
Yes. I'm pretty into it, but like, one reason I love the minis is I just love hearing Dan laugh at how ridiculous Elliot is being. And like, sometimes I feel like they get a little bit, this is not a criticism, it's just like, it's just an example of a show that I love more than almost anything. And sometimes when I see that there's a guest, I'm a little bit like, like, I know you got to do that, but like, I really just want to hear you boys be stupid. You know, there are shows where I'm like, oh God, I know you have a podcast. And now I'm speaking generally, I'm not talking about the podcast. Hi, Dan. But like, it seems like there's this thing where you're like, you've got to have guests. Because what do guests do? Well, guests are good because why? Well, let's be cynical and point out the obvious. People who like, okay, No Such Thing as a Fish, one of my favorite podcasts. It's the people who do the research for the British quiz show QI, and the four of them are fantastic. I love No Such Thing as a Fish. I love their chemistry. But, you know, and sometimes when they have a guest, it's fantastic. But, like, freaking Malcolm Gladwell was on the latest episode. And, like, my eyes almost rolled out of my head. But I'm like, okay, I put it on. It was excruciating. Because Malcolm Gladwell personally is excruciating. His whole bit, like, gets under my skin. And it's just weird, though. But then on the other hand, sometimes, again, with Blank Check, the people that they had on during the John Carpenter series, it was so good. Or in the instance of the Bob Fosse series, having Julie Klausner, I want to say, who actually appeared in Fosse Verdon in a small role, like having her on to go like happy go jappy on Star 80 and talk about what an execrable movie that is was fascinating, because it kind of put Griffin and David, you know, on the back foot a little bit, because, you know, she really like ran that thing. And I don't know if it was totally successful, but it was super interesting and unusual. I'm not against stuff like having guests, but I, for the shows where I'm there for the chemistry and the jibber jabber, I mean, do you ever feel that way? Is it just me?
So the Flophouse, I think, is the only show that I listen to that isn't a guest interview show that I pick and choose, and isn't a show that basically never has guests. So it's the only one that has guests frequently enough to be notable, because like, I listen to plenty of podcasts that have 500 episodes and one guest ever. So that doesn't count.
Right.
So, you know, I'm aware that guests on the Flophouse are a thing. And there are some people who I don't even consider guests, like Hallie. I don't really consider a guest. Like, she's more like, I don't know, special guest star or whatever. Like, she's not that she's on a million episodes, but her chemistry is well established with the crew, and so it is very familiar. And it is, you know,
like she's on the show art now.
Yeah,
seeing a ghost.
Right, exactly. Boy, she would love that. But then on the Flophouse, depending on who the guests are, It has to, I think mostly has to do with is how good are the guests at podcasting? Yes, some of it has to do with how much chemistry they have with the people, but
to quote Mabim Bam, will you play with them in the space? Like, how much do you have to change? That's a really good point, because how much does the show have to change to accommodate the person who's on here?
Or how able is the person to participate in the show as it exists? And I feel for that, too, because I often, as podcast listeners do, you fantasize about what you would say if you were a guest on the show. And I, having never been on the Flophouse, I can pretty confidently say that it's a lot harder than it looks. Like, that if you were there in real time with the Peaches, it would be, and when you have, like, for example, if you hear a guest on the show and it seems like, boy, I haven't heard from the guest in 45 minutes, it's not that easy to jump in the middle and play with them in that space, because they're playing real fast and they've got a lot of sharp toys. And it's very complicated and is not as easy as they make it look.
Right. Elliot is just one of the bosses that you must defeat. Stu can come in from left field, and Dan can come in from left field. And, like, it's the kind of person who says, I could get in the ring and, like, fight a boxer. And it's like, well, yeah, but could you fight three boxers? And also, you don't really know how to box.
Yeah. And so
be fine. Yeah.
That way, I feel for a lot of the guests who sure. quote unquote, don't do well, because it's a hard gig, right? Do often wonder, you know, like, there are guests that disrupt the chemistry. Either it's because the hosts don't quite want to incorporate the guests, but see that the guest is flailing and try to help, or because the hosts sort of, like, just do their thing while the guest is there, and they get sort of short shrift. Like, and so there are episodes where I feel like that episode didn't work, and the reason it didn't work is because that guest didn't work out, whether it's because they're, you know, wherever the fault lies, it just didn't sort of gel together. But then there are episodes where the guest is just, you know, amps it up to the next level because it's someone they're really getting along with, or, like...
Well, and there's an elephant in the room in some ways, which, okay, there's a thing that happens. So you have somebody on. And, like, for example, when we choose a guest for our annual member episode, you know, it's not very scientific at all. But I have to say, not just because of my ego, I would really prefer to have somebody who's familiar with the show on the show. And there's this really awkward thing that happens when you bring in a celebrity. When you, or like, anybody who's, like, way more famous than you, like, a lot of people get really weird and nervous and they don't act like themselves. And Alex, for example, starts calling everybody by an honorific, you know, like Mr. Sandwich or whatever. And it gets kind of odd. But also there's this implicit understanding, I think, in a lot of these shows. I'll come up with the name for what kind of show I'm talking about. The three white guys talking type shows. There's an implicit understanding that the guest is familiar with the show and their bits. Like, everybody, and Blank Check, you know it's going to end with the box office game. We're going to go through whenever that movie came out, like that usually month, Dave is going to quiz Griffin and see if he can guess what the top grossing movies were, because he's really good at that. But then, you know, you have, there's all these implicit things, or, you know, the bit. Okay, one of my favorite bits, is, it used to be a retired bit and they brought it back, but I think it's a very funny bit. Starts in the very first episode, like the Phantom Menace episode. It starts with David casually mentioning that he grew up in England, and Griffin going like, whoa, what do you mean? You grew up in England? And now it's still, I'm glad they brought the bit back. Anytime David mentions that he saw this movie at Leicester on Poxbottom theater, and usually Griffin will jump in and go like, wait a minute. You telling me you grew up in England? But sometimes the guest is the one who does it. Sometimes the guest is the one who knows the bit and goes, wait a minute, you're telling me you grew up in England? And then you hear the sounds of Big Ben and you laugh. But like, there's that implicit thing of like, maybe Lin-Manuel dips in and he hears like an episode, but you can't really treat him like somebody who's going to play with you. And I think it makes it awkward sometimes.
Yeah, I mean, in those cases, you almost have to transform the show into a vehicle to extract value from the celebrity guests. Because, like, people who are tuning in, it's like, if people are tuning into this one, they probably want to hear whatever story Lin-Manuel Miranda wants to tell about whatever thing he's literally ever done in his life.
Because he also produced Fosse Verdon. He was of course a great guest on that show, and then he did a rap for Ben Hosley's birthday. Producer Ben Deucer. Yeah, I it's a little bit of a Chesterton's Fence thing here, even, I guess, which is like, I don't know. It seems like there's a lot of pressure to have guests. And then there's this little part of me that, like, as somebody, I was not a child of divorce when I was a young child, but I was around children of divorce. And it almost feels like this kind of, I don't know, this awkward sort of tiptoe thing that you have to do, like how you talk about things. I don't know. Some guests that I love, some of my favorite things have been done by guests. Like I say, if J.D. Amato is on Blank Check, you know that's going to be a banger because he always has something. Like if J.D. Amato walks in the studio and hands you a sealed envelope at the beginning of the podcast, you know it's going to be a good podcast. But yeah, I don't. Let me ask you this. We can wrap this one up. I'm going to ask you a weird left field question. I'll give you a second to think about it. So we've done our member episodes, which are, as the English say, anons. It's a once a year thing where we have a guest and our members can hear it. You go to relay.fm/rd/join. Who would be a fun guest on this show? Who's somebody that you would be thrilled to have be on this show just some week?
I think we're running out of people who listen to the show, honestly.
I feel very much the same way.
That's part of the problem.
That's why we threw up our hands and did the obvious and said, my God, please, Marco and Casey, please come on. Because I love your show. I love those guys. And I think they listen to this show so they can play in the space. I mean,
it's less important for our thing because it's literally a once a year special thing that only members hear. But for this
regular on main show, I don't think it's our deal. In fact, I think it would be a little bit weird.
It's absolutely not our deal.
No, it would be almost willfully gimmicky to do. But is there anybody? What, Christian Lattner? He went on here. Larry Wall?
Christian
Larry
Lattner? Wall still?
Is that his name? Christian no. Lattner? Chris Lattner?
Not. Yeah.
Is Larry... Chris Lattner's dead. He passed?
No, Chris Lattner. Still alive.
Christian is alive. Doc Chris. Is here. Doc is not here.
So many Chris's.
What about Larry Wall?
I mean, he's still know. Kicking. Like... That's kind of the problem. Like, so you mentioned like, the pressure to have guests. I, again, the only show I listen to that has sporadic guests is The Flophouse. And I never got the impression that they're under any pressure to have guests. I think they want to have guests partially
but
to
the,
make
But as
to,
a child of divorce era kid, I always feel like I wonder, not The Flophouse in particular necessarily, but like, I always think like, have they lost interest in...
They're trying to spice up the marriage?
Exactly. They're bringing they're doing a throuple or a quadruple.
Yeah, I don't... In the case of The Flophouse, I don't think that's it either. A lot of the time, it's because it's people that are meaningful to them when they had, like... didn't they have Stuart Gordon on or something? Or, I don't... Or they had...
No,
I think
he was just on Twitter.
All right. Okay, so maybe not. But, like, they had...
He settled...
What's her name?
He's... Unfortunately, supposedly, he settled Ding Dong Gate.
Yes, he did. The star, one of the stars of the slasher movies they used to watch. Like, these are people that are meaningful to their
lives. She was great. The woman, Beverly, the woman who's in all the slasher movies. Yeah, she was great.
I mean, and so, like, I can never fault them for having, like, their heroes on, their heroes of cinema on their show, even if they will readily acknowledge that it is not an interview show.
If it's that stellar, it can be fun. Like, you know, if it's somebody, like, again, I mean, Lin-Manuel Miranda, I guess people have mixed feelings about him. I think he's great. I don't understand the weird TikTok make fun of Lin thing. My kid doesn't, and my kid doesn't even know why they do it. But like, oh, you know, he made this face or whatever. Mm-hmm. But having him on to talk about All That Jazz, which admittedly is one of my all-time favorite movies, the guy who not only is the producer, like Fosse Verdon was, I think, produced by him. The guy who directed Hamilton is the director of the episodes. And on top of it all, he plays Roy Scheider. Okay, so Lin-Manuel Miranda plays an actor who plays the Romana Clay version of Bob Fosse, played in this case by the amazing Sam Rockwell. You know, but like if you do the thing where like if we brought in somebody, I'm trying to think on Dubai Friday, Max used to love bringing in guests and he would bring in these people without like, I won't say asking, but without telling us. And sometimes it was just death, you know, like the guys from Linea, like, okay, the guys who run that commercial where they talk about the pans on TV. I mean, there were elements of that were very interesting, but it's not an interview show. And like, I don't think that's what people tune in for. I'm just being a karma suck. So who's our guest? Are you going to get Christian Lattner?
A good example, our version of the, I guess I could remember her name. I can practically picture her face. Barbara Crampton. There we go. I knew it would pop out of it.
Oh, my God. Yes. She was such a good sport.
Yeah. So our, you know, my personal equivalent to that, which is basically like, you know, someone who is meaningful to you, a hero of some medium or another, who you would just be honored to have on your show, even though you know your show would be a terrible episode with them because you're not a good interviewer, but you just want to have right. any kind of interaction
this,
like, with them.
Sort of
whatsoever.
Like this one's for me. Shut up. This one's yeah. for me.
And not even for me, because you know, after it's over, you're going to feel terrible about all the stupid
so
things
stupid.
You said
yeah,
and what a bad
right.
job you did
well,
and what a bad time.
You go into Chris Farley mode, you know?
Yeah. Well, yeah, exactly. Well, or, you know, whatever the case. That person is, that's Jonathan Colton for me. That's why we'll never have him on the show, because he doesn't know anything about the show. He doesn't care anything about me. Yeah, I'm a fan, but he's got a million fan. Who cares? And it would be just death.
He's charming.
It would be death to have him on the show.
He was on Back to Work. And at one point, Dan went on sabbatical and I decided to have guests on. And he was fantastic.
I'm sure I heard that episode, and I'm sure it was, because he does know you
man.
And care about you, but he doesn't know me or care about me. And so
Rob Corddry, very good.
But again, these are all people who you had on who know you, right?
No,
so
they know of me. They know I'm still, the do your email.
Well,
guy.
Whatever they you know whatever they agree to be in the show because there's something. So
I have started calling Nate Corddry Uncle Nate, which is kind of weird. He plays Neil Simon in Fosse Verdon. Have you watched Fosse Verdon? It's the
no,
challenge.
He's,
this week.
He's the first gentleman. No spoiler. Sorry, I didn't say the name of the show.
He's the guy that does the graffiti in Ghostbusters. He's in a lot of things.
Mm-hmm. Did you know the first gentleman thing that I was referring to? Don't ruin it.
No.
Good.
Give me
okay.
A,
well,
give me
spoilers
a
then. No, I don't want to spoil it for you. If you don't know, you don't know. And then you're,
I don't even know. Like, is it a movie or a TV show?
I'm
or
not going to tell you.
I just have to keep looking for Nate Corddry to be
no,
in
No, you don't
things.
Have to look at all. I just was wondering if this was a thing that you had seen, and by the fact that you didn't get the reference, the answer to that is no, you haven't seen it, so problem solved.
Huh.
But yeah, if we had Jonathan Colton on, that would be an example of someone I would love to have on, even though I know the show would be terrible and I would feel bad.
Okay, all right. Maybe for your birthday. You got a birthday? Come on, when's your birthday? Wait, yeah. I know your birthday, December, right?
No. As I think I said on a long ago episode regarding Jonathan Colton,
I've been offering. I mean, I haven't.
No,
kept...
That's why I said both me and Jonathan will be relieved to know that our relationship has run its course without us ever communicating. That's the way the relationship has run its course in
you
my head.
Just show up on a cruise. Looking him dead, with dead black shark eyes, just looking him in the eyes.
Yeah, I'm never going on a cruise.
Mm-hmm.
No offense to cruise.
Go monkey like to have a Mountain Dew. Go monkey, very simple, man.
I don't
big warm fuzzy secret.
I don't like boats.
Go monkey like you.